If Bob didn't say it, then it probably ain't true. This is Primetime Sports with a man who cannot tell a lie. Bob McCown. Primetime Sports. Now on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Well, hello, it's Friday. It's March the 27th, 2015, Primetime Sports on your radio and on your television, if you so choose. I'm Bob McCown, and this is the nation's most listened to sports talk presentation. Your phone calls in the first hour, as usual, and you're getting smart. People are queuing up early. 416-870-0590, star 590 on your cell. 1-888-666-0590, toll-free across the country. Later in the program, a roundtable, of course, after at the top of the next hour, Stephen Brunt, Elliot Friedman, Arash Madani, all in studio with a variety of things to discuss, as we always do on Fridays. Meanwhile, the topic of discussion is yours to choose. You may go in any direction you do so desire. I have an arrow, I have a topic, but I don't have a guest name. Danny, Toronto, you're first today. Hello.
Greetings and salutations, my friend.
Ditto.
Okay, now, you're the guy I've been wanting to ask this for a long time. It's sort of a business of sports question.
Go.
You know how the Los Angeles Dodgers got this gigantic cable deal? Therefore, they could spend really a lot of money on their players. Now, the Toronto Blue Jays is owned by the cable company that broadcasts their games. Does it hurt the Jays or does it help them? Number one. Number two, can another cable company bid on it, and give them more money to work with? That's basically it.
Does it help or hurt is a really interesting question. Because they don't share with me how they actually manipulate the money or what fee they actually assign to the broadcast rights. And I suspect they don't do it because they change it on an annual basis. And this is what you or I would do in order to mitigate the tax implications, either for the Blue Jays or for Rogers itself. So I can't tell you what it's worth.
So they don't have like a five-year contract or anything. They do it on a yearly basis is what you're telling me?
Well, I don't even know that for sure, but I'm led to believe that that's approximately how it works. That there's no real upside to having a long-term contract. It's left pocket, right pocket money. You know, it's not it's not two entities that have to talk about things, really. Does Beeston sit down with Keith Pelley at the end of every year or periodically and do some kind of a deal for the broadcast rights? That seems kind of silly to me that they would even contemplate doing that since they both essentially work for Rogers. So if it were me, it would be an annual deal, and I'd decide, okay, this year we don't want to put too much money into Rogers, and the Blue Jays have already lost money, so there's no tax implications there. So we'll make it small. The next year, if in fact the Blue Jays made, and this is purely theoretical, $20 million, it may be advantageous to charge Rogers $20 million post facto for the broadcast rights, which would make the Blue Jays' net profit zero. Right. And their corporate tax implications would be nothing. So that's how I would do it. Now, do they do it that way? They don't tell me that.
Not that it would ever happen, but let's say the rival company, the ones that they're in bed with on the other.
You can say Bell.
Franchise.
You can say Bell, yeah.
Okay, cool.
We're not like those guys. We actually mention their names.
I love it. Now, what if like they were to say, we're gonna give you $5 billion for a 10-year contract? I'm just throwing numbers out there.
Well, okay.
Would Rogers, they have to look at it, wouldn't they?
Well, I would. I mean,
damn right.
I mean, I don't know what that number is. It's a lot less than $5 billion, but like, for example, if they came back with a deal comparable to what the hockey deal that Rogers just bought was, if Bell called Rogers and said, we'll give you $5.2 billion for 12 years of Blue Jays baseball. If I'm Guy Lawrence, I'm looking at that deal. In fact, I'm not even looking at it. I'm saying yes. Because you're still in the business of making money. And what we are told is the Blue Jays lost approximately $18 million last year. Is it a real number? I don't know. I'm the first to confess. I'm only repeating what I've been told. But there'll be years, maybe this year, where they'll be profitable. What the value of Blue Jays baseball would be to another broadcaster is a really intriguing question. And part of what I don't know is, what is the cost of actually doing the games with all the people that are involved, the technology that's involved, the travel that's involved? And do advertisers underwrite or subsidize some, all, or way more than all of those costs? In other words, as a standalone entity, absent rights fees, does Blue Jays baseball make money for Rogers? And I don't know the answer. I can try and find out. I'm always skeptical. It's not the kind of thing they want the radio broadcasters, especially big mouths like me, to know, because they know immediately I'll go right to the air with it. But it's something I will inquire about. Randy and Milton, you're next. Hello.
Hey, Bob. How you doing?
Good.
Good. Bob, you know, the whole interview that you had a couple days ago with Lanny McDonald really put a sour taste in my mouth. And, you know, if I could summarize it, is that's so NHL, I think would be the best way to describe it in my perspective. And, you know, it just really burns me where there's this secret society that, you know, they have a point of view, they have a strategy, but they don't want to share it with the public and the media, the whole upper body, lower body injury, and the whole, of course, the whole secrecy towards the Hall of Fame vote. And, you know, it just reminded me of the sporadic moments of emotion where Thomas Hertl scored his fourth goal in his first NHL game, and he got criticized for showboating. And, you know, Neil Yakupov doing an exuberant celebration when he scored an overtime game-winning goal. And, you know, to me that is, you know, not malicious trash talking, but just excited to play the game. And just like, you know, it just shows a little bit of color. Like, I'm a huge Leaf fan, and I think the most marketable players are Luongo, because he's somewhat open with the media, and definitely a PK Subban, which is, you know, a sin for me to say. But what I wanted to ask you was, you know, what say the powers that be in the NHL, if they took a different stance, if they actually promoted, you know, freedom of expression and sort of, you know, saluted the Thomas Hertl, like, say, on their Twitter accounts or something like that, you know, actually get some, you know, people that actually have a personality, maybe that this would grow the game even more. Maybe there would be interest, say, in a city like Vegas, because the way I see it, the NHL is the most exciting game, but it is played by the most boring, most socially inept people.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far, but I do share most of your comments. I get angry at the NHL. I don't dislike the NHL. I like the sport. But I don't like the sport today, and it frustrates me no end when I hear the endless parade of hockey pucks. And I'm not talking about, you know, guys over at TSN or people at other networks, or I'm talking about even our own people. Continually parade the notion that the game is better today than it's ever been. That is just poppycock. We are in the entertainment business. and so is the National Hockey League. And the value of the entertainment being produced by the national by the NHL today, in my opinion, is well below what it should be and what it could be. And the frustration for me is that they do nothing about it. Because at the beginning of any fixing has to be an acknowledgement that there's a problem. If you don't think your sink is got a leak, you're not going to fix it. You have to acknowledge that there's a problem first for you to go and fix it. Until they acknowledge, are prepared to stand up, are unafraid to stand up and say, you know, we've got great athletes and they skate like hell, but the coaches have taken over this game. They've made it way too defensive. The puck's along the boards all the time. We've got to find a way to open things up. People, they've virtually eliminated fighting from the game, and I'm great with that. I don't know whether they did it for any reason other than fear of lawsuits and concussions and injuries. But whatever the reason is, I don't care. I'm just happy they did it. Having said that, why won't they take the same position when it comes to the style of play, the quality and quantity of offense that is produced by this league? It baffles me. It's like a group of people that are so insecure about their product, so afraid to say anything negative about their own product, that they can't acknowledge what they are actually watching. So when hockey people walk into this studio and tell me how great the NHL is right now, they believe it. It's difficult to have a conversation with somebody and change their opinion when they believe it is actually that good. And maybe I'm nuts, and it wouldn't be the first time. But I'll tell you this, I get way more tweets of support for my position than people who defend the NHL. I don't hate the game. I hate what the game is. To have goaltenders that are starting to look like lacrosse goaltenders is ridiculous. It's not necessary. You can change it. They didn't even address it at the general manager's meetings. It wasn't even a topic. Goal scoring is down again in the National Hockey League. If you don't have a 920 save percentage, you're probably in the minors as a goaltender. If you've got a goals against average over 3, you're a bum. Used to be, if you had a goals against average under 3, you were a star. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it's great. Scoring is what brings us to sports. It's the reason we watch. You want to see points. The National Football League game is as good as it's ever been. I know there's lots of issues in the NFL, plenty of them. But the game itself is really pretty good. They're scoring lots of points. I mean, cite the case where you know, you saw a 6-3 or 12-6 football game and said, wow, that was a really great football game. I hope we get more of those. Like, I can't stand these 35-34 games. I mean, you've never heard that. And the National Football League continually changes the rules in order to promote scoring. Do you think Major League Baseball wants 2-1 baseball games? Or would they rather have 5-4 or 7-6 baseball games? They'd rather have the latter. Now, they move as slow as donkeys. But maybe under this new commissioner, it'll change. See, The core of the problem is the unwillingness of this league to look at itself reasonably and rationally and honestly and not be afraid to stand up and say, you know what, there's some things we want to fix. There's some things that we don't like that much. We want to fix them. We want to find a way. We're going to find a way to inject more scoring into this. We don't think anybody's going to complain if there are more goals in the NHL or in the game itself. My God, when I was growing up, you go to a junior game at Maple Leaf Gardens, and it was not uncommon to see 10, 12, 15 goals in a game. Not uncommon. A goals against average in junior hockey of by a goaltender of under 4 per game was phenomenal. Today, it's like 2, 2.5. Goal scoring is down everywhere because everybody's playing the same kind of game. Somebody needs to stand up and say, we got to fix this. Moving on. Chris Burlington, hello.
Hey, Robert. Quick story, then a point on the NHL. You were sharing with your listeners a story about 1975 and you being at Yankee Stadium. I was there with 20 buddies, went to a game in the afternoon, Shays, and then went to the Yankee game in the afternoon or the evening. We sat behind home plate, and the pitch of those seats is unbelievable. It was vertigo when you stood up to try to get back
there. You're in the upper deck?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it was, I told people, I went down on my butt. I was all by myself in Yankee Stadium, went up to the top deck, and when I turned around and looked down, now, there, if I remember correctly, there are railings in front of every row.
That's right.
But I literally went down the steps on my butt. I was by myself. There was nobody else in the entire ballpark, and I was afraid.
Well, fortunately, it was packed, so we could just sort of work our way down.
I understand.
As far as the NHL goes, I think they really blew an opportunity back in 88 when the Saddle Dome was built. It was built with Olympic-sized ice. If every arena after that had Olympic-sized ice, we'd only have two arenas next year left without it.
Yeah, I mean, in all honesty, I used to say the same thing too, but repeatedly what I've heard, as recently as yesterday, Colby Armstrong was in here, and he went to play his last professional season, I think last year, in Sweden, played on the big ice and thought, this is going to be great. You know, I'm going to be able to score some goals, have some room to move around, you know, be able to dangle the puck a little bit. He said the game is way worse. Now, is that a North American hockey player reacting to expectations? I don't think so. I think the notion of a larger ice surface isn't all that maybe I thought it was. But understand this. In my own defense, my objective has always been more offense, more offense, more offense. I'm willing to try anything, anything. There are some obvious changes. It's probably going to take you 5 years to figure out exactly what the right balance is. But if you're not even addressing it, and they aren't, it wasn't even on the agenda for the GMs, then you know there's no change coming. There's no chance of change coming. Look, I think most people are happy with the idea of either more overtime or fewer players on the ice during overtime. Any effort to have games decided on the ice rather than in shootouts is good for everybody. I like that. I'm with it. I think I got no issues with that suggestion. But they're dealing with, you know, a 5-minute period instead of dealing with the 60 minutes that come before, where the majority games are still decided. And as a former goaltender, I have great sympathy for goaltenders. But you know what? Goaltenders only want to be the best. If you're the best with a 1.9 goals against average or the best with a 2.9 goals against average, you're still the best. This is not an anti-goaltender thing. It's an entertainment thing. I thank you for the call. Here's our friend Johnny in Hawaii. Hello. How's the weather?
It's not too bad today.
Good.
But it's only 10 a.m. here, so.
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering if you, I don't know, as somebody who used to have a show on the business of sports and enjoys talking about the business of sports, and I heard your interview this week with Darren Revell, and there was something in the Wall Street Journal today that with the fight upcoming, unless you're in an MGM resort, so if you can explain to your audience that the Las Vegas Strip is basically controlled by two entities, and then you have Las Vegas Sands as a third and Wynn Resorts as a fourth entity. But MGM basically controls the Strip.
They do now. They bought a bunch of other properties, right?
They're not,
including Bellagio, et cetera.
They've made it clear, and they've made the other casinos aware of it, and they're going to have people patrolling this. None of the other casinos are going to be able to show the fight. It's they've released in a press release today that only MGM casinos or MGM-owned resorts owned casinos are going to be able to have the fight. It's the first time that this is being done in Clark County, and they're saying that they won't enforce it in other places outside of Clark County, but in Clark County, which basically Las Vegas is encompassed, they will be enforcing that it cannot be shown in a gaming establishment. How is that going to affect this big fight?
That's a real interesting question. As you know, I'm going to Las Vegas for the fight, but I'm not staying at the MGM. I'm actually staying at Caesars. If by some stretch of the wild imagination I do not have accreditation for this fight, it would be mandated upon me to find some place to watch it, which means I guess I'd have to go to an MGM resort in order to watch, which would be slightly inconvenient, but not the end of the world. So let's see how this thing unfolds.
With that, Bob, I have one follow-up to that.
Sure.
Is this because it's going to be such a fight and the dollars that are being talked about are so
off the charts?
Yeah, off the charts. I don't even know what word to use. Are they trying to make sure that they get all the eyeballs or all the players possible in their resorts? Because, let's be honest, I understand you're staying at Caesars, but all these places are charging huge amounts of dollars, especially MGM resorts, the New York New Yorks, the MGM, the Bellagios, the Aria, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Are they trying to make sure that they get all those eyeballs and all those players into their resorts and hurt the other resorts that are just going to get the money from the first day?
Yeah, here's what I would say to you. I think their investment is whatever it is sizable. And when you control an event, when you purchase an event, and that's what MGM did. It wasn't given to them. They bought it. They are taking the risk on it. I think as a business, you're entitled to try and captivate the audience. The notion of us doing a deal with Bell if the Blue Jays make it back to the World Series is ridiculous. It's ludicrous. It's crazy. You wouldn't do it. They wouldn't do it with us. You want to maximize the dollars and the eyeballs and the exposure, mostly the dollars, that you can generate off it. So I have no issue with MGM Grand's policy if, in fact, it stands. What remains to be seen is how will they deal with... You must remember, Las Vegas is a city of 2 million people now. It's more than just the Strip. 99% of people who go to Las Vegas go from McCarran Airport to the Strip and never leave it. Only 5% of all that visit there rent a car. You go to Florida, 95% of people rent a car. I know people that have been to Vegas 100 times have never left the Strip, have never gone to a restaurant one block from the Strip. So, for me, it's not the end of the world, because I'll get in a car or get in a cab and I'll find a place to watch the fight if I'm not at the MGM, if I don't get accreditation. I think most people will react that way. The great danger here, I think, for MGM is are they establishing a policy that is going to last, so that the next time somebody has a big event, and maybe it's not MGM Grand, are they going to take the same position? And then all of a sudden, MGM Grand is on the wrong end of the stick. That's the only question that I have. By the way, Drabek claimed by the White Sox. What am I looking at? Oh, hello. You're finished. Goodbye. Sid Sixero waving through the glass. So the Blue Jays put Drabek on, I guess, they tried to send him down, had to put him on waivers first, and the White Sox have claimed him. Not a tremendous loss. Nice kid. Hoped he would have made it. Tommy John surgery, et cetera, et cetera. You know the whole story. But didn't really figure in the Blue Jays' major league plans this year, or realistically, there was no discussion of him in the foreseeable future. So we wish him good luck with the Chicago White Sox. By the way, the last piece of the Halliday trade. So that deal is now concluded, for whatever that's worth. John Pottageville, hello.
Afternoon, Bobcat.
Sir.
Woodbine Entertainment wants to get gaming tables. I think by doing this, well, okay, people don't go down the Queenie or up to 400. Do you see any problems with this, or is it a good thing?
This casino thing has changed so many times over the past few years since the OLG announced this, you know, this new criteria, this plan to, they created all this, these areas, and they want casinos of various sizes all over the province of Ontario. And, you know, they're going to put one in Toronto, and they're going to put one here and there and everywhere. And they closed down a bunch of the off tracks. And then they changed their policies. I don't think the RFP has even gone through. They announced some plans and then scuttled them completely. This thing is a colossal mess. A colossal mess. So my response, I guess, is I don't know what Woodbine is thinking of doing. I don't know why this should come up now. I don't know how this is different from applying for any of the other licenses that are apparently going to be available. They were talking about opening casinos by 2017. There is no chance of that happening now. They'll be lucky if they do applications by 2017, the way these donkeys are running this thing.
I guess, well, you're proving my point, because when the Vegas people came up here a year ago and they were talking about putting one down at Ontario Place, the Vegas people didn't stay here too long. So I guess,
well, there are still Vegas people involved with various groups. There are at least two groups that I know of that have substantial size that are applying for a variety of licenses, and both of them have Vegas partners. Now, that doesn't mean that, I mean, these are Ontario-based individuals or entities, companies, that have solicited the counsel and the money of major Las Vegas players. And it only makes sense. And the Vegas players mostly are, you know, now have, they don't just deal in Las Vegas. They have facilities, gambling facilities, all over the United States. 40-something states have legalized casino gaming. They're not going away. They just came to recognize that hanging around Toronto waiting for these bunch of dopes to get off their asses and figure out what they're doing is a waste of time. Might as well go back to Vegas. You know, call me when they come up with a plan. I mean, it's a colossal blunder. But it shouldn't be surprising to anybody. My position on it has been crystal clear for decades. Government should legislate, not operate. Let people who know what they're doing do it. You control it. You tax it. You be the Uber administration, the overseer. Protect the people. Obviously, protect your own financial interests. But having government-run casinos is absolutely absurd. And it is just so, so Canadian. 29 past the hour. We'll take the break and come back with more of your phone calls. It's prime time on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks.
Did Bob McCown just say what I think he said? You can rewind Primetime Sports Podcast when you subscribe at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan, on demand. On demand. On demand. Now, more of Bob McCown and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
American woman, stay away from me. That's just outside our studio as Sportsnet throws another singles party where all the staff of Sportsnet tries to pick each other up. Ain't no telling what kind of dangerous date drugs there are out there. But you got a bunch of hockey pucks. You know, you got to be careful. Get what you pay for. In the middle of it, Scott Moore holding court because he thinks he's throwing the party. Sad, but true. Where to here, boys? Chuck in Scarborough, hello.
Bob, first-time caller.
Thank you.
I enjoy your program.
Thank you.
You were speaking, I think, with Joe Cilley earlier this week concerning pitchers and why the arm. You were asking a good question, why the arm was breaking down. And, you know, I went and I did some research. I'm the son of a jockey from my home country. And before I go to the horses, let's talk about why. I personally think that the arm is breaking down. Think of two words, breast milk. The older generations, why we had these, the old pitchers rallying and pitching so well, the younger generations, the mothers, some of mothers are not even giving the kids the breast milk. They're using all these concentrated stuff.
Wait a second. Hold on. I get, you know what? I can't have a conversation with you about breast milk. In all seriousness, maybe there's something to that, but it's got to be more than with all due respect, I mean this sincerely, than somebody who spent 5 minutes thinking about it and said, "Well, you know," it's very hard for me to take this conversation seriously. If you're able to absolutely pinpoint the absence of breast milk as the reason why pitchers' arms are breaking down, then by all means send me the information. But as a supposition, I can't straight-facedly sit here and engage in that conversation. Gary in Oshawa, hello.
Bob, it's good to have you back. It's not the same without you, buddy.
Thank you.
Listen, I just wanted to say... I heard your frustration, which I've shared for years, about the goalies in hockey preventing, with their oversized equipment, preventing more goals and entertainment. I agree wholeheartedly, but the thing that's getting me right now, I'm banging the wall, is this, against the wall, is this condoning by the National Hockey League, and I know to some degree the other professional leagues do it too, of allowing teams to tank purposely. In my mind, it is a criminal act, not only for the fans who went to that Buffalo game a few weeks ago with the Leafs here, and neither team was interested in winning. They have a professional responsibility to put on a performance where they need where they want to win, and that just wasn't happening. Now we have a situation.
Well, wait, hold on. Okay. I'm going to take a little bit of issue with what you say, because I have a different perspective on it, and which does not make me right or you wrong, but it's different. Here's what I would say to you. I grew up in an era where if you finished last, you got the first draft pick. There was no lottery. There was no 20% chance or 25% chance. You finish last, you pick first. You finish second last, you pick second. And down the list. This notion of trying to create a greater competitive balance, greater integrity in the game by this draft lottery is complete and utter BS, and you cannot be drawn in by this. This is nothing more than an act on the part of professional sports leagues to create another day of interest and revenue for themselves. It has nothing to do with anything else. It is complete and utter BS. That is all that this is about. Teams, the Buffalo Sabres are going to get the first pick in the draft. There isn't a player on the Buffalo Sabres that isn't trying. And if he isn't trying, he's crazy because he's going to be out of a job. When you're on a last place team, you are the most susceptible to lose your job. The people that are potentially tanking are the general managers and the owners.
Exactly.
So it's not the individual teams. They're playing their asses off. They're trying to win. If for no, the vast majority of them anyway. I mean, I guess if you're Phil Kessel and you've got an 8-year, $88 million contract, and it's probably going to take you to the end of your hockey career, give or take. And I'm not saying he's on cruise control, but maybe he's one of a handful of guys that could be. He could say, "At a hell with it. I'm not going to get hurt. I'm gonna take it easy here. Why should I give a crap if they don't give a crap?" And I think we would all kind of endorse that position.
Yep.
But there's 18, 19, 20 guys on that team that are fighting their asses off to stay in the National Hockey League, to keep a paycheck coming. The notion of having a lottery is absurd to me. I don't think any team realistically tanks at the beginning of the year. I understand the Philadelphia 76ers proclamation. I get that. But you really can't control it. If you have, as long as commissioners have the right to intervene when trades are made at any time during the year, you can control the product. If the Philadelphia 76ers had come out of the chute and won 6 out of their first 10, I'm trying to be realistic here, and then had two good young players who were lighting it up, it can happen. And then tried to trade them because their entire objective was to be bad. The commissioner can veto that trade. He can prevent that from happening. That should be the objective of the league. Not to create some cockamamie rules and regulations and draft and ping pong balls and computer generated numbers and percentages and chances and this. It does nothing. It changes nothing. Here's the reality of sports. Some years, your team is going to suck. And why shouldn't they get the first draft choice if they're the worst team? Explain the logic. Why should the second worst team have almost the exact same chance? I think in the NHL, last place team is a 20% chance. Second last team is 13.5. Like, really, what's the difference in that? It's negligible. Nothing. Mathematically speaking, you'd have to go through 30,000 years in order to have a real difference, to see a real difference between whether the last place team or the second last place team actually got the draft. It's an absurd number. It doesn't work. And they know that. They have mathematicians who can tell them this kind of stuff. They do it so they get an extra TV show, extra conversation, extra attention. It's about money, people. James in Oakville, hello.
Hey, Bob. First time, long time.
Thank you.
Love the ideas for the increased scoring. I think that's what the NHL needs if they want younger fans to get involved and like the sport. So my idea to increase scoring would be wins get you into the playoffs, 1 through 8, whatever the number of teams you want to get in. But the more goals you score equates to who gets So let's just say the number six team has the most goals.
They get the first seed.
They get to choose who they want to play.
Oh, okay.
So if you're better against
I got it. Yeah.
You go, I want to play that team. And so it would be an incentive to score more goals. So it actually means something at the end of the day.
Okay. Only problem I have, I have a similar idea. And I know it's pretty revolutionary, but the reason I like mine better is because now if I want to really know who's in first place, I got to look at two sets of standings. I'm going to look at the point standings, and then I got to look at standings and who scored the most goals, and then try and figure out who's ahead of who, all things being equal. It has become so difficult to read the standings in the National Hockey League today with overtime games, overtime losses, how many overtime wins we don't know. They just include those in wins. And all the other statistics. I can remember when it used to be wins, losses, ties, points, goals for, goals against, that's it. Now, columns are this wide, like the size of an elephant's butt. So here's what's easier. And I know a lot of people won't like it. I'm not sure I like it, but I'll tell you it would work. You get 4 points for a regulation time win, 3 points for an overtime win, 2 points for a shootout win, 1 point for a tie. If you lose in 60 minutes, you get nothing. Then every goal you score over two in any game gets you another point. Add them all up. Here's the column. Boom. This is how many points you've got. Tonight, if you score 19 goals, you get in the playoffs. Pretty simple, pretty straightforward. But it's revolutionary. And this league is anything but revolutionary. We got time for one more, I think. Marcello in Niagara Falls. Hello.
Hi, Bob. Great show, by the way.
Thank you.
Increasing scoring in the NHL. I know you're upset with the NHL, but I think there's two reasons. The first reason, probably everybody can see that, is the goaltending equipment. It's twice the size it used to be.
Correct.
I mean, when I was growing up, I mean, they said 80% of the goals were on the ice. Now it's the other way around.
Yep.
The game evolves, right?
Yeah, and the goaltenders are playing a different style. They can do it with the kind of equipment that they're given.
Because of equipment. Because
goaltenders are a lot bigger than they used to be. There's all kinds of factors, but you have hit the core. The equipment is too big.
But I think when they go down, the pads, the way they're made is like they're like...
I know. I understand. I'm with you.
There's no five hole anymore.
I'm with you.
And the second thing, I think, Bob, is really important. I had three kids go through minor hockey and my way up to midget and to junior hockey.
Okay, you got 30 seconds. Quick.
Sorry, the coaches nowadays, they coach not to lose, not to win.
That's right.
Not to lose. It's all defense.
The answer, I hate to cut you, but I got to. I'm out of time. I apologize. I agree with what you're saying. You know, I said before, you can teach defense, but you can't teach touch. You can't teach a kid to score goals. You can't teach a kid to be a goal scorer, to have that intangible, innate ability to put the biscuit in the basket. Can't teach it. You can practice it, but you can't teach a guy how to do it. So the enemy of good hockey are the 30 coaches in the National Hockey League. That's the enemy. They're the guys that have taken this game to where it is right now. There's a bunch of them I like and a bunch of them I respect. But as a group, they coach not to lose. And the best way not to lose is to keep the game as low scoring as possible and hope for a chance, hope for a fluke. And if you aren't prepared to even acknowledge that, you have no hope of changing that. And that's the NHL today. Stephen Brunt, Elliot Friedman, Arash Madani will all join me. The roundtable's coming up. Maybe this topic will be on it. Perhaps not. Hope you'll stick around. We got another 2 hours to come. This is Primetime Sports. We are coast to coast on the Sportsnet radio and television networks.